Hey everyone, and welcome to the Sunny Go One Piece podcast. On this episode, we're going to be diving into episodes 271 through 273, which will cover manga chapters 384 through 388. And I've been waiting to talk about these next few episodes for a long time, pretty much ever since I started this podcast, with our first real Luffy power-up introduced. So let's get into it. So the synopsis. The Straw Hats continue to make their way closer to the courthouse and Luffy, but have to contend with all sorts of enemies and resistance from the world government forces. The CP9 get a major power-up as they're gifted two new Devil Fruit powers, but not to be outdone by that, Luffy has his own major power-up as his fight with Bluno reaches its climax. Thankfully, there really aren't too many differences in this set of episodes, with just being a couple minor. There's one scene that's kind of shuffled around slightly with the Straw Hats and the Franky family invading the courthouse. That entire scene was pushed till after Luffy activated Gear Second, but in the manga, it actually precedes that moment, and so they kind of just flipped the two, most likely just to sort of end the episode. What was it, 272, on that cliffhanger where he activates Gear Second. But then they start the episode 273 with the courthouse push. And the other difference that they was introduced is in the fight with Bluno after he activates Gear Second, there's a couple extra moves thrown in there, like Jet Spear and Jet Missile. Jet Missile is actually, I think, an anime original, if I'm not mistaken, because I don't think that ever appears in the manga at all. And so, yeah, those couple moves were added in the anime to sort of pad out the fight to fill up the entire episode. I don't necessarily care about that because they're both pretty awesome additions, and they really don't really add or take anything away from the whole thing. So kudos to Toei for that. But yeah, that's really the only differences we get in these set of episodes, which is awesome. So yeah, let's jump into the episodes themselves. They start off with Kokoro explaining to Nami and the others that there's another obstacle that they'll need to overcome, and that is the massive pit that we observe between the courthouse and the Tower of Justice. And she goes on to explain that there are mechanisms in the courthouse that will allow them to drop the drawbridge. The Franky family decide that they'll get the bridge down for the Straw Hats and they'll continue to press forward. However, just then, all of a sudden, Gomora is attacked with these massive wrecking balls, incapacitating him and rendering them sitting ducks, and it looks really bad as they begin to get surrounded on all sides. But just then, we see Oimo and Kashi regain their composure as they close in on the battle as well. But it'll be some time before they reach the others. The Galila Company guys have nothing left in the tank as they've been fighting Marines nonstop. And seeing the two giants come back into the battle have kind of deflated them, while the Marines are cheering, thinking they've got some much-needed major reinforcements. But naturally, we know what's really about to happen thanks to Usopp / Sogeking. And they turn on the Marines for lying to them and enslaving them for 50-plus years. And leading the charge is none other than the Sniper King himself, Sogeking. And this is such an awesome and goosebump-inducing moment, as Sogeking has truly just flipped the tide of the battle in a massive way, and he's just epically leading two giants. I mean, it's crazy to think that Usopp has got two giants basically following him. And there's just something so satisfying about seeing Usopp succeed like this. As for most of the story, and I mean the entirety of One Piece, he's always kind of struggled to keep up. But then in every arc, he has those moments where he kind of flips everything. But in Aeneas Lobby, he gets multiple moments because this saga, as much as it centers around Robin and Franky, this is also Usopp's sort of character development story as well. And seeing the underdog, you know, Usopp succeed like this is immensely satisfying, because most of us will, you know, whether we like it or not, identify with Usopp, as he is sort of the everyman / everywoman in the story, in that, you know, if we were actually to be thrown into the world of One Piece, we would probably be closer to Usopp than we are to any of the other Straw Hats. So it is really satisfying to see this. And then jump to the Tower of Justice, we see Franky a little jealous of Robin that her crew has come to Enies Lobby to save her, and no one does for him. And he's a little salty about the fact that his family isn't here to save him, but obviously we know that they are. Then we get a really interesting scene with the CP9, as Spandam has given Khalifa and Kaku the two devil fruits for them to consume. But this scene does a lot to sort of add to the lore behind the devil fruits themselves, because up till now, we haven't really gotten much info on them outside of, you know, eat them and you get powers while getting cursed by the sea. That's about it. But here, Jabra talks about an urban legend that if an existing devil fruit user gets too close to another fruit, the devils inside them, quote unquote, will emerge and battle each other, and that ensuing battle will end up killing the user. Bruno then mentions that that is in fact a false urban legend, but what Jabra is referring to has some truth in it, that if a person consumes two fruits, then they will explode and die. Lucci added that the risk of carrying that much of the curse is just not possible for a human to take. And what's interesting here is that there's both sort of a scientific component as well as a supernatural element to this explanation, as Bruno talks about how research and experimentation has been done on the devil fruits to sort of prove this, while Lucci speaks of curses and sort of magic, you know, the sort of the supernatural element of the devil fruits, which begs the question, who's doing research on the devil fruits? And could it be the one that created the technique that allowed the Inu Inu no Mi to be incorporated into the gun that created Lasso that Miss Merry Christmas mentions all the way back in Alabasta? And it's these little things in sort of the background, like very like tertiary or almost like quadtiary. I don't even know what the word is for that, but just like incredibly far in the background. But it's just this thing that's happening in the world of One Piece that makes it so, it feels so real and so fleshed out, in that even beyond our main characters, our secondary characters, and even our tertiary characters, there's this even ever bigger world of One Piece that's happening in the background that we never actually get to see, which is this sort of the idea that the devil fruits are being researched on and experimented with, and there is a lot going on there that we just don't know about. But it gets us very curious to wonder, like, what is happening and how, what are the devil fruits really? And I think that's one of the things that people fall in love with One Piece, and why it's so fun reading One Piece, is because not only are the main characters fun, but just trying to figure out what all these like extra things in the world is, and all the mystery surrounding it that Oda creates, it makes it even much more, it makes it way more fun to just sort of think about, you know, after you're done reading or watching One Piece. And, you know, in everyday life, you're just kind of like wondering, what is this? Or you come up with theories about this, and it's really fun. And I think that's one thing why One Piece has lasted for so long, is because of the fact that it can engage you even after and you know, while you're sort of waiting for the next chapter or next episode. What's really interesting, though, is we now know that it's impossible for a person to have two devil fruit powers, which I know was on everyone's mind up till now, because I know I was thinking about that. It's like, what happens if a person eats multiple fruits? Do they get multiple powers? And I personally always just assumed that we hadn't seen a dual wielder because of just how rare the fruits were in the world, and that the chances that the same person would have the opportunity to eat multiple fruits were just, you know, the chances would have been, you know, astronomically improbable. But I think Oda needed to explain it here for the first time, because he's got two fruits just sitting right here, which would obviously raise the questions from us, the viewer, like, why doesn't Lucci or Jabra or Bruno eat a second fruit to get even more powerful? Or why doesn't one person like Kaku just eat both of these? And what makes this more interesting is that Spandam doesn't know what the abilities, you know, are inside them. And so it's a bit of a gamble as to whether they'll get useful powers or not. But Lucci kind of echoes the same sentiment as Crocodile, in that no matter what the fruit is, it's really up to the user to master the fruit's powers. And I like the sort of the dynamic of Jabra being the sort of like the immature, confrontational one, as he's trying to convince them not to eat them out of his own selfish desires to not be overtaken by Kaku and Khalifa in terms of power and status in the CP9. It's also revealed that the devil fruits taste like ass, which makes Luffy munching on his Gomu Gomu Mi all the funnier. As he, in the first chapter or in the first episode, he's just so hungry and willing to eat anything and doesn't even care how bad the devil fruit tastes. And he makes it, like, if you think back to that first time you see him munching on the Gomu Gomu Mi, he actually makes it look tasty. But it makes a lot more sense that something called a devil fruit tastes bad. And although I suppose if you wanted to go sort of the biblical route and equate the devil fruits with something akin to like the forbidden fruit from the creation of humans story, from the Bible with Adam and Eve, that maybe the fruit was a bit more tastier. We unfortunately don't get to see what their powers are yet, as that's a surprise saved for later. And when they do ultimately use it against the Straw Hats, it also brings up the line of thought of how do devil fruit eaters figure out how their powers work, especially ones that have specific conditions that need to be met for them to work. For example, like the Mane Mane no Mi with Mr. Tubonkle, he's got to touch people with his left hand to copy their appearance. I mean, does that happen through trial and error, or does the fruit itself grant some sort of knowledge on how the fruit works, much like the forbidden fruit of knowledge, if we're going back to sort of that biblical Adam and Eve story? I personally like to think that the fruit gives them sort of this inherent knowledge on how to use them. But it is also amusing imagining people just discovering their fruit's powers by accident. Like, for example, Buggy accidentally cutting himself one day and figures out, oh, I can break myself into pieces. But again, that just kind of adds to that sort of like the mentality of like thinking about One Piece after you're done watching or reading it. You're just kind of like thinking through to yourself, like, and it's fun just kind of like coming up with all these little things outside of the main story. Speaking of the main story, as interesting as all this sort of devil fruit theory crafting has been, it's taken a while for us to get back to the main event of Bluno versus Luffy. And in this next phase of this battle, Bluno begins to show off how he combines his door-to-door powers with the Rokushiki techniques, and he ends up using his powers to appear in unexpected places and putting doors at Luffy's feet, trapping him there while turning his eyes into a revolving door and making them spin, which again makes me realize there's no end to Oda's creativity and how he utilizes the powers he creates. And I can honestly say I would have never thought of using the door-to-door powers like this. And I don't think a lot of people would. And I'm always continually surprised and entertained by how Oda actually interprets his powers and how he uses them. Unfortunately, this is all we get of Bluno and Luffy for a little while, because we then return to the remaining Straw Hats, where Gomura musters all of his strength to get back up and push himself to get everyone to the courthouse, even though his injuries have left him nearly blind, according to Chopper. Chopper then explains that Gomura is pushing himself so hard because he made a promise to Sodom to take everyone the rest of the way and to save their precious Franky. And that is a really super touching moment. And again, it's really short, but that small amount of development really sells this scene and really displays how action scenes need that sort of that emotional foundation for us to really care about what's actually happening rather than just seeing a bunch of random things happen on screen. And it enhances, cool action by investing us in the action because we care about the characters and the outcomes. And I think that's kind of lost on some other, movies and series and TV shows where they just throw action scenes just for the sake of throwing in action scenes. And I think this one small thing really sort of demonstrates how important that is. But yeah, as they reach the end of the street and head to the courthouse, everyone begins to worry that Gomura is going to gravely injure himself even further by charging straight into a dead end. But Zoro and Sanji coolly come to the rescue again by mentioning they don't see a dead end and immediately just bust the whole wall down. And this quote is obviously played for the cool factor and some laughs, but to me it stands out because it kind of highlights their way of visualizing approaching obstacles. And I mean there as in Zoro and Sanji. Everyone else around them sees the dead end and lose a little bit of hope and start to get really concerned. But Zoro and Sanji have already visualized a solution and a path forward to the point where the obstacle doesn't even really register for them anymore. And obviously, this can't be directly applied to real life, as we can't actually break down walls, like, brick walls like that. But it does warrant a step back and for us to reflect on ourselves and how we look at obstacles in our lives and how we can, you know, tend to give up or view it pessimistically and immediately when faced with an obstacle, instead of visualizing and believing in the solution or sort of the positive outcome, even if it may be absurd or a very difficult solution. And I know this is a mindset that I have often consciously have to be aware of and actively avoid falling into that trap of giving up before even beginning just because of some seemingly insurmountable challenge. But yeah, it's something that, you know, I think all of us tend to struggle with. And so I like that this sort of moment has that sort of underlying message for it. But yeah, just some food for thought there. Also, I have to mention, this is another nitpick about the direction and editing of this scene. So in the anime, there's a great panel of Zoro and Sanji bursting through the wall with Gomoro coming in behind them as he's sort of framed by Sanji and Zoro on either side. And it's awesome, but the anime decides to break this shot up into multiple boring single shots of each element. And again, it gets the story and the point across, so you know what's happening, but it just kind of robs the moment of this sort of grandness and badassery that it deserves. Not to mention, it looks a hell of a lot worse in the anime. But, you know, it's just, I wish it could have done what it did in the anime by doing each element by itself, you know, showing us a shot of Sanji, showing us a shot of Zoro, and then showing us a shot of Gomora with the destruction happening around them. But I wish that they would have at least included that big, grand shot of Zoro and Sanji flanking Gomora as he's, you know, passing through all the debris. I think that would have been really cool, but that shot is nowhere to be seen in the anime, which is, again, a little disappointing, and I don't know why they decided to direct it that way. I don't know if it was like a time and budget thing that they just couldn't fit in that last scene, and they had to do the individual shots to make sure that the episode is long enough to fill that time, which, again, is another issue in and of itself. But, you know, I know they're doing the best they can, but it's a little disappointing when you have this, like, amazing shot in the manga and it's not in the anime for seemingly no reason. But anyways, enough ranting aside, let's move on. But with that, Gomora does manage to get everyone to safety and through to the courthouse. Shifting back to the Tower of Justice, as Spandam is sort of playing with his buster called Golden Denden Mushi, he finally gets alerted that there's an emergency update, and he almost pushes the button, which I find a little bit comical. Thinking that things are still fine, he brings the update Denden Mushi over to Robin to be a sadistic bastard to rub it into her, but comes across a massive shock learning that they've all reached all the way to the courthouse, and instead of the 5 or even the original 500 casualties, it's now gone up to 2,000 casualties, which freaks the hell out of them. And then we go back to the courthouse as the Straw Hats examine the current situation as to how they're going to get up to Luffy as quickly as possible, and they again get attacked by those Wrecking Ball wielding Hulk guys. But Yokozuna gets his huge hero moment and blocks the incoming ball attack, protecting them all. Then something weird happens that I remember confused me a bit, as Zoro just kind of yells at no one, calling them an idiot, and it'll be a waste of time chasing after an enemy that continually runs. But then out of the shadows, Sanji kicks the crap out of one of them, and you realize before anyone noticed, even me, that Sanji has run off and caught one of them. While everyone is all amazed at Sanji's speed and strength, Zoro not being outdone impresses everyone by cutting a huge section in the lower gate to make them a path into the courthouse, shocking everyone yet again. But yeah, this scene really confused me when I first read this in the manga, because it's not quite clear as to like what happened. Because it just seems like Zoro is just yelling at someone, and you know, when you put the pieces together, you know that he's yelling to Sanji. But in the manga, it just seemed really weird. I don't know what it was, but the way the paneling was done, it just wasn't quite clear as to what just happened. I mean, seeing the anime does help a little bit, but even in the anime, it's just kind of weird. I don't know if it's just me. It probably is just me, because it makes sense. It's just, I always had a hard time, like, connecting the dots. Now, finally getting back to the 1v1 duel, Luffy is relieved that his head door has finally closed and stopped spinning. And of the little added detail that Bluno throws in there, he mentions, of course, doors closed. And I just find that little detail or unnecessary expansion of his power is really cool. Just kind of adds to the immersion of the world for me. And they continue to trade blows, avoiding each other's attacks virtually at a stalemate. But then the most amazing and chills-inducing thing happens. And I cannot tell you how excited I have been to talk about this moment. And to this day, I still remember the first time I read this development in the manga. This was game-changing and a huge evolution for the series and Luffy. So anyways, enough of me gushing. Let's get into it. So Luffy just stops and says, "This is no good," and talks about how losing to Aokiji made him realize that he needed to become stronger in order to protect his Nakama. We finally get to see the first steps to the payoff of that storyline that started all the way back in Long Ring Longland, where Luffy's growth and development as a captain started. And it's not enough to mature mentally as a captain, but he needs the strength to be able to back it up. And this is that moment, as Luffy mentions, he's figured out a new technique to help him fight to his fullest strength, paying off all the foreshadowing we've had about this new technique that Luffy has been wanting to try. Although one side note here, I don't know why, they flash back to the moment with Luffy punching Aokiji from the Kokoro no Chizu opening, but the weird thing is that moment actually never happens in the manga or the anime. Again, like I mentioned when I talked about the opening, that scene is just created specifically for the opening, because in both in the manga and the anime, he punches his stomach and that's how his hand gets frozen. But yeah, anyways. He then squats down in his now iconic pose and begins to compress his rubber legs into sort of a pump, seemingly pumping more blood up into his torso, turning him into this shiny pink hue with a large amount of steam coming off his body, as if he's like super hot now. And one thing I love about seeing this in the anime is hearing Mayumi Tanaka's acting in this scene. Because when Luffy says, "So I won't lose anyone again," it's still the normal tone of voice. But then when pumping, you know, when that pumping action has been done, she makes her voice more strained and more gravelly when she delivers the line, "So no one will be taken far away from me." So it's like, "Daremo ushinawane yoni," and then, "Daremo toku ikane yoni." Like, he just like gets this more gravelly voice, and God, I get chills every time I hear that. Then Luffy looks up at Bluno and says, "You won't be able to keep up with me anymore. All of my attacks have just evolved," and we're all just like collectively like, "Oh shit." Like, he then bends down, placing his fist on the ground in the now iconic pose, yelling out, "Gear second." And oh man, this was so cool at the time. I mean, it still is cool. Because for the first time in One Piece, we have a transformation. I mean, Luffy has a freaking transformation. I didn't think we'd ever see anything like this in One Piece. And, you know, for all of us Dragon Ball fans, I know we were all collectively thinking, this is Luffy's Super Saiyan moment. And the absolute hype and surprise of this reveal was just incredible. Because I, at the time, had no idea this was coming. And to this day, I think it is one of the best and most iconic moments in One Piece. Like, when I first read chapter 387 for the first time, I still remember not just this moment in the story, but how I reacted to this moment and everything surrounding it in my life. It's just like, I remember like just sitting there reading this. And it is still one of my favorite memories, reading or watching One Piece. And even to this day, I love watching this scene of him just bending down and doing gear second for the first time. And this moment was monumental. Like, unfortunately, we won't get to see this new gear second actually, what it actually does until the next chapter / episode. I mean, luckily for us, we can just go straight into it here. But man, it was rough when it was originally, published or aired. And although we were kind of spoiled in the brand new world opening, which is a real bummer for anime-only watchers to have seen what this actually looks like in the opening, like almost several months ahead. But I think Toei has sort of gone the route of assuming that you just watched the anime or read the manga. But anyways, that's another point. When episode 273 starts up, we quickly catch back up with the Straw Hats and the Frankie family invading the courthouse to find a way up to the top. It's here Zoro is unleashed to clear as many soldiers at once, and he uses an upgraded form of an old move we haven't seen in a while, his iconic onigiri, and he's now got this sort of demonic presence that surrounds him as he cuts even further and faster, dubbing it the Enbima Yonezu Onigiri, or translated, it's like Charm Demon Sleepless Night Demon Cutter. However, we have another funny food wordplay with Zoro's move names, and if you read it slightly different in terms of the intonation, it becomes Ebi Mayonnaise Onigiri, which is translated as Shrimp Mayonnaise Rice Ball. That's a really funny one. Which is really similar to the yaki onigiri or the fried rice ball that he uses on Little Garden. Because onigiri is just rice ball, and so you could just do anything you want with it by adding sort of a prefix to it to make it any type of onigiri or any type of rice ball. So the combinations that Oda can play with Zoro's onigiri are endless, essentially. But yeah, I love this. I particularly love this wordplay. Of course, we get another Zoro is bad at directions joke, but at this point, it's kind of bordering on the absurd as he's going in the direction where no one is. And I find these jokes funny, but I will admit it is a little silly now how he becomes this bad with directions when there are people literally in front of him telling him where to go, and he still gets it wrong. But I do love the exchange afterwards, though, where Chopper talks about attempting to make a medicine to cure his sort of hopelessness, with Nami requesting that it also do something about Sanji's craziness as well. And I like the sincerity that Ikue Otani delivers this line as Chopper is like really legitimately going to try and figure something out, which is pretty funny. Not to mention the fact that when the Frankie family witnesses this, it's also pretty funny, as not even a minute ago they were all impressed with how capable and strong all the Straw Hats were, and now they're kind of doubting whether Frankie could actually be saved and if he's in safe hands with these people. But anyways, with that out of the way, we can finally get back to Gear Second. And first of all, I love Luffy's quote here, how he's glad that he was able to meet them here as he's finally able to figure out a way to protect his Nakama. And we'll see what he means by that a little later, which I'll also elaborate on in a second. But we finally get to see what exactly Gear Second is, and it is magnificent. Luffy stands up and sort of aims with his left palm stretched out and readying his right arm for an attack. And they really play this tension and reveal up both in the manga and the anime, which is awesome. And I love that this is treated with such reverence in both mediums, because this is a big deal. I mean, this is a really big deal, because this is Luffy basically taking the next step above. But Bluno, still underestimating Luffy, just kind of brushes this off and tries to dodge it with Soru until Luffy screams out, "Gomu Gomu no! Jet the pistol!" and freaking blasts Bluno in an instant with this punch with incredible speed, punctuated by this distinct whistling sound because it's piercing the air so quickly. And I love the sound design of all the moves Luffy uses in Gear Second. That sort of whistling sound does such an amazing job conveying the speed of the jet attacks. And it even sounds like a jet plane speeding past you. The anime really shows the force and speed behind Jet Pistol really well, but in the manga, the impact and damage to Bluno is much more apparent, as it's a freeze frame of the impact, and you can see his body just rocked with the eyes whited out. I mean, both have their pros and cons, but I recommend you check them both out, because they're both amazing in conveying how, you know, the power behind the Gomu Gomu no Jet Pistol. But before moving on, though, I have to admit something that's kind of embarrassing. And I don't know if any other manga readers at the time thought this way, too. But when I first read this in the manga, I interpreted all of the Gear Second jet moves completely wrong. So in my head, for the longest time until I saw this episode premiere, was that all the jet moves were Luffy sort of punching or hitting the air so quickly that he was like punching compressed air at the target. And it was like this sort of burst of air hitting Bluno. And the way it's drawn in the manga, where you never actually see any of Luffy's limbs hit Bluno, made me believe that he himself wasn't hitting Bluno, along with the fact that the new moves were called Jet Something, made me believe that this was some sort of air compression attack. And I remember seeing this episode and thinking, oh, that makes so much more sense now. And when I went back to the manga after watching this episode for the first time, I was like, oh, Oda was trying to convey the snappiness and the speed of the punches. But for like several months, I was envisioning Gear Second as something completely different and wrong to what it's actually supposed to be conveyed as. And yeah, I just felt so stupid at the time when I first saw this episode, thinking, how did I ever come to that conclusion? But yeah, that's kind of a good case study for why I think you should both read and watch the anime and manga, because it's a... Yeah, I think they both add something to the experience and the overall story. Because there are just some things that are lost in sort of the medium of comics, you know. There is something to be said that you can do a lot more with the addition of full motion and sound and music and acting that's kind of just lost in the comic medium. Which is why I've always never really liked that whole argument of like, oh, anime's better or oh, manga's better. I think they're both great in their own ways and they both add to the story, especially in the case of Japanese, you know, manga slash anime stories, because they're usually pretty direct adaptations of each other. So they don't necessarily contradict each other. They enhance each other, I think. Anyways, this really shocks Bruno as his face when he pushes away the smoke. That face always makes me laugh so hard because he is just in full-on shock and panic mode here as he thinks to himself that he can't even see Luffy at all. And not only are Luffy's attacks fast and stronger, he himself moves even faster than Soro to the point where Bruno can't even see him anymore, which is incredible when you think about it. I mean, not even like a few days ago, Luffy just got his ass handed to him by Bruno, and now he's just completely overwhelming him. And yeah, Bruno then gets barraged by a bunch of attacks from all directions to the point where he just can't keep up at all. And so he has to run into his air door realm to recompose himself and come up with a new strategy to beat Luffy. But when he tries to sneak up on Luffy again, Luffy's just way too fast and avoids the attack. Luffy then talks about how he figured out Soro back on Water 7 and that he observed that they all kicked the ground like 10 times in an instant to move that fast. And I'm still not entirely sure what that actually means. I think it means that they kick off the ground 10 times in an instant to sort of generate the force needed to propel them at that speed. But I've never actually gone ahead and tried to look this up or see what the discourse is among the other fans on what this actually means. But that's just how I pictured it in my head. Maybe I'll go look it up later at some point. I've never really cared enough to want to look it up. But yeah. The crazy thing is this is kind of foreshadowed, and if you think all the way back to Syrup Village with Captain Kuro, we've actually already seen a crude version of this with his Shakushi. If you remember, he could be seen shuffling and tapping his feet really quickly each time just before he did his Shakushi. However, Kuro's Shakushi was kind of incomplete compared to Soru, as when he did it, he had no control over where it went or who he attacked, because he hadn't mastered it, like the CP9, with relying mostly on just instinct, which is why he sort of goes into that trance-like state where he sways back and forth and then goes on to attacking. But nonetheless, it's a pretty cool callback to something from all the way back in the beginning of the series. But this next part is what I was referring to when I said I wanted to kind of talk about what Luffy mentions, is, you know, how he was glad he ran into the CP9 because he was able to learn that there was a technique like this out there, and he sort of copied them and learned from his opponents to the point where he observed the trick behind Soro. And of course, this is a cool storytelling and character growth moment for sure, but for me, the message behind this was huge, especially a young me just at the beginning of my college days, and the idea of using one of the most humiliating and worst defeats and using that experience to learn and grow from it is huge. I think it's something that many of us struggle with. We often experience failure or defeat and just kind of treat it as such and not try to take something away and learn from it. I see so many times, especially people who haven't experienced much adversity or defeat, just kind of sulk and become absorbed by their failure until they sort of just kind of move on. This mindset of looking at your failures, you know, seems obvious, is not an easy one to adapt because it involves you being honest with yourself without judgment about what you did wrong and even looking at one of your worst moments of your life to try and take something positive away from it, I believe is a huge lesson in life that everyone should strive to adopt. I mean, Luffy, instead of focusing on how he lost, he asked why he lost and focused on positively growing from that experience rather than looking back on the negatives of what he was lacking. And I admit, it's not always easy to do that, as I myself have found myself dwelling on the past, blaming myself for mistakes and failures. But I always think back to Luffy and this moment and see what can I learn from those experiences and how can I extract the positives from even some of the worst situations I've ever been in. If there is anything you gain from One Piece, I hope it's this lesson, because I think this will go a long ways in terms of helping you sort of navigate some of the more difficult moments in your life. And it certainly has for me. I always, you know, no matter how bad of a situation I'm in, I always find myself trying to see what positive thing can I take away from this, despite how bad it was. Anyway, sorry about the long tangent, but this has always been something that was really important and impactful to me in my life, and it's just that I wanted to devote some time to it. But with that, though, let's get back to the action as Bluno, still in denial about Luffy's true strength, decides to take on Luffy by withstanding him using apparently the strongest version of Tekkai called Tekkai Go, Go meaning strength, against Luffy's Gomu Gomu no Jet Bazooka, which just saying that seems like a crazy strong move. And I freaking love how this move is depicted in the anime, as you see it from five different angles upon impact, just to emphasize how hard it hits. In the manga, it looks amazing too as well, as it's just a 1.5-page spread with some incredible detail as to the impact it has on Bluno. And I love how Tanaka Mayumi screams, "Gomu Gomu no Jetto Bazooka!" And it's just like, psh! I mean, oh man, it's such a cool moment. Bruno's seemingly looking like he tanked the move. Luffy then starts to gear up for something else, starting to say gear while biting down on his thumb, but then being cut off by Bruno finally succumbing to the damage and passing out. Which implies that there's potentially a third one, like gear third? Like what? There's more? I mean, something more powerful than this? Presumably, he's saving this till he faces Lucci. So not only is Oda kind of spoiling us on another, with another transformation, and I don't mean like spoiling us in the story, I mean essentially saying he's giving us more great stuff in one arc. I mean, he's not only giving us one transformation, but two, which is crazy to me, but we won't get to see it now. I remember some people at the time were a little apprehensive about One Piece introducing transformations for fear they might become what Super Saiyan became in Dragon Ball, but I personally thought this was the perfect time for One Piece to introduce this into the story, as this really is the next big step for Luffy and the Straw Hats to take, as, you know, they're in the wider world of One Piece now with sort of the world government involved, more and more pirates are getting involved, and it makes sense that Luffy would also take the next, you know, leap in terms of strength and power, and it makes perfect sense. And, you know, this transformation isn't necessarily like Super Saiyan or anything, because you clearly see that Luffy is extremely exhausted after doing this, and he mentions as such. And so, you know, this is kind of a showing us that this is a limited sort of thing that Luffy has to be careful about using, because it does tend to wear him out. And I have to imagine that this would actually play a role in, you know, a longer extended fight if you were to have to use Gear Second for a long time. But we'll see more about Gear Second later in this arc. So yeah, the episode closes with a quick update on where everyone is, with Luffy finally being within shouting distance of Robin and makes his presence known to everyone, including Robin, that he's come to rescue her. And the next episode, we get to see my favorite moment of all time of One Piece. I can't wait to talk about it. Anyways, if you did enjoy this, send me a like or comment. And if you want to join me on this journey of rewatching One Piece, please consider subscribing. A big thank you to everyone who's listened or supported this podcast, because it's grown to the point where I know, and you may be able to tell that there are some ads in there now, but I can now monetize the podcast and everything. So I really appreciate everyone's support. Check out my Instagram and Twitter account at SunnyGoPodcast if you want updates of when I post new episodes or see pictures of my manga collection. And as always, I wanted to thank you for taking the time out to listen to my podcast. There'll be a spoiler section, so stay tuned for that if you're interested. But if not, stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the next episode. Bye. Alrighty, so spoiler section. Again, my spoiler sections are going to be largely unscripted, so it's just going to be me mostly rambling. But there are a couple of things that I wanted to talk about, because a lot of big things get revealed here. First off, mostly concerning the Devil Fruits. Obviously, here it's established that no one person can get more than one Devil Fruit power. However, this then sets up that sort of shocking reveal in Marineford, where Blackbeard does in fact somehow gain two Devil Fruit powers, and it's still a mystery to this day, as of chapter 1053, of how Blackbeard managed this. And there are a couple theories out there. One of the most prevalent ones, and I'm not sure I believe this one, but it's the theory that Blackbeard is actually like multiple people, or either he's physically like a triplet, or he's got like multiple sort of personalities within him, which explains why everything about him is sort of in threes. Like his beard is threes, his pirate Jolly Roger is three skulls, standing back to back to each other. Each of his sort of personalities has a fruit itself. Or the other prevailing theory is that something about his original Devil Fruit power, his Yami Yami no Mi, is what allows him to eat the fruit. Or maybe the fact that he already had a initial fruit that we are yet unaware of that allowed him to eat both the Yami Yami no Mi as well as the Guraguro no Mi. And so he's now actually has three Devil Fruit powers, and so he's got the original one that kind of allows him to eat multiple fruits, which allowed him to eat the Yami Yami no Mi or the Guraguro no Mi. And yeah, it's still not quite clear. I haven't really sort of landed on which theory it is. I honestly think it's a lot more simpler in that, yeah, I'm more of the fact that maybe he found a fruit that allows him to eat multiple fruits. I think that's more of the prevailing theory for me, because the other ones just seem really out there in terms of like, how does that even really work? Some people have said that like his other selves are hiding in the Yami Yami no Mi, but that doesn't necessarily explain like where have the other, he doesn't get the Yami Yami no Mi until after or sometime during the Enies Lobby. So like when he's sort of, we see him on Jaya and all that stuff, like, where has his other two selves been? Because people have mentioned the fact that, yeah, they're hiding in sort of the dark realm, which also seems really horrible, to sort of cast your other selves into. I don't know. It's really weird. The other thing too is this sort of story about Bluno mentions that there's sort of research being done. And I think we pretty much well established now at this point that it's Dr. Vegapunk who has been doing all this research. And the interesting is Dr. Vegapunk is also another mystery that we still yet have no real idea as to like who this guy is, what he's actually doing, what his goals are. We just know that he's a scientist that, you know, experiments on devil fruits, and he's the one that created Momonosuke's artificial fruit. He's the one that does all the figuring out how to introduce devil fruits into inanimate objects and all of that stuff. And yeah, I think this is sort of the first reference of Dr. Vegapunk, even though he's not actually mentioned by name. And yeah, it's just interesting how this sort of grows from sort of the explanation that Bruno gives here, and how the wider world just keeps expanding. And then next, the last thing I kind of wanted to mention, because I know this episode is running a little long, is the sort of the tease for Gear Third. Now, for me personally, Gear Third is a little bit of a letdown. I mean, even to this day, after Gear Third, Gear Fourth, all the different forms of Gear Fourth, you know, with Snake Man, Bound Man, and Tank Man, and even Gear Fifth with Nika, I think Gear Second is still my favorite. So when I saw Gear Third, it was definitely kind of a letdown for me. It's still cool, but I think it's such a departure from, you know, him and his normal fighting style. Whereas Gear Second, it's still Luffy and his normal fighting style, just kind of enhanced further. And so, yeah, I think Gear Third is interesting. But I think one of the big things that was revealed with the sort of the introduction of the, you know, the Nika fruit is the fact that Luffy's attacks and his techniques and his strength is only limited by his imagination. And that's actually partly baked into the powers, you know, the fruit's power. And so the fact that I think one of the big sort of criticisms at the time about this is like, how did Luffy gain these like huge power-ups without really training like Zoro does or anything like that? And, you know, one of the big complaints was that like he just attained this sort of power-up too quickly and too abruptly. But I think with the introduction of, you know, the Hitohito no Mi, the model Nika, it's explained that Luffy's strength and power and his moves are only really limited by his imagination. And so the fact that Luffy just saw the CP9 do something like this and he just wanted to figure out how he could replicate that and just let his imagination go wild. And we've already seen Luffy go to some crazy lengths in terms of his imagination to come up with moves. And it's not really out of the realm for him to just sort of like come up with and think about all of this. And so I think that kind of explains and closes that loophole. Not that that, for me, I don't think it ever needed to be explained anyways, because there really is no training montage aside from obviously the 2-year time skip. And so I never really felt like this needed to be closed, but it is interesting that Oda did finally manage to sort of close that almost like 10, 15 years later. But yeah, it's anyways, this is getting really long, so I'm just going to end it there. But yeah, thanks for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode. See ya.